You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello. Why do I get such a big build-up this time?
I don't know.
I'm not often.
Because you're worth it.
We're physically in the same place, aren't we?
Television's Daniel Freib. Lionel, where are we?
We're in King's Cross in London.
We were at Vermouteria, our new hangout. Daniel, did you try the vermouth?
I did. We got a free sample. I'm not 100% sold on it. It's a bit sweet for me. I don't really like sweet things.
You're in London though, Daniel. I'm saying yes. You had an interesting coffee experience yesterday.
Oh, that would take a whole podcast to tell that story. I was absolutely fleeced.
But what about the order? What did you order?
Oh, a cappuccino and a cardamom bun, or a cap and a Cardi B, as the beard stroking Herbert behind the till called it.
Oh dear.
Sorry, I'm not going. I didn't reveal where it was, so that's. I'm allowed
somewhere
to be rude
London.
And offensive.
How anyway. Was your cap and Cardi B?
It was fine. It was pretty regulation. I'd never had a cardamom bun before, but it was fine. Yeah. No.
How many English pounds was it?
Lots. Mm, yeah.
That's one of the problems with London, isn't it?
But, yeah.
You know, you're used to Italy where it's a euro for a coffee.
Well, to be honest, I was just relieved to have anything that wasn't French coffee. I mean, I was very grateful to ASO for having a final day that at least it was a sort of final day coffee stop in Switzerland, and they took pity on everyone who had been on the Dauphiné for a week, and they took us to Switzerland for the afternoon to get some decent coffee and some Rivella. Soft drink of choice.
No, this is kind of this is European iron brew as far as I'm concerned, this stuff.
It's, what's wrong with iron brew?
There are a lot of people on the Dauphiné not happy to go into Switzerland. Switzerland is a country that, ironically, infamous for its inveterate neutrality, it's a country that really divides opinion. You don't like it much, do you?
I think it's beautiful, and it's very clean. It just feels like every time you're there, you're just there to open your wallet and pay more for things than really you should.
And you need different plugs, and you need a thing for your windscreen on the road, and there's
different data
hassles.
Roaming rates.
Oh yeah,
all that.
It's a great flag though.
It's a faff, isn't it? It's a faff, Switzerland.
Yeah. It's a good advert for the EU, but maybe we shouldn't go there.
Well, yeah. Do you not remember the year the tour had its rest day in Bern? And yeah. We spent about a week's worth of budget on two nights. Well, that's the problem.
That year there were rest days in Andorra and Bern.
Yeah.
Bern is beautiful. It was a beautiful place to be for the day. But anyway, you are at the Dauphiné. Daniel, lots to report on from
this.
This is our first podcast since the Giro, isn't it? Our first regular podcast.
And what? Two more after this before we'll be in Brussels for the Tour de France.
Yeah. If you missed it last week, we were covering the women's tour, the Oval Energy women's tour, with daily podcasts from there. And we've still got a little mini special to come from there as well, from Orla Chenoui's day in the Canyon SRAM team car.
Can I ask an ignorant question? OVO, it's got nothing to do with that. I think there's a Swiss link here, because Ovaltine is Swiss, isn't it? What? OVO's got nothing to do with Ovaltine, has it?
It's an energy company.
It's an energy company.
Okay, that's what I needed to know.
Not Ovaltine.
Okay.
I'd have thought you'd be really anti-Ovaltine. Kind of a race.
Yeah, I'm
goes
not a
well
big
with
fan.
A
I'm not
cardamom
a big fan.
Bun, I would think. Anyway, Lionel, have you got a news roundup? There's been a bit of racing.
There's been a lot of news, hasn't there?
Yes.
Team Ineos have had an absolute shocker of a week or so, haven't they?
A season.
In spite of winning two stages at the Dauphiné.
Yes.
Well, yeah, but overshadowed completely by a terrible crash for Chris Froome in his recon ride for the time trial at the Dauphiné in Roan. Daniel, you were there. You can fill us in on what's happened there, but the headlines are that he crashed very heavily while going downhill on his time trial bike, took his hands off the handlebars to kind of clear his nose, and ended up in hospital with a fractured femur, broken hip, fractured ribs, and a fracture in his neck, and likely to be out for perhaps 6 months before he's back on the bike or back in competition. We're not too sure how long his recovery will take, but what we do know, he's definitely out of the Tour de France, so there will be no fifth Tour de France victory for Chris Froome this summer.
Quick one on that, just we'll maybe return to this, but when I was speaking about this incident to Tim Harris, who is the oracle on all things cycling at the Women's Tour, he said ban time trial bikes.
Wow.
They're unstable, they're unsafe. This illustrates it. Time trial bikes, get them on normal road bikes for time trials, then everyone's equal. Bike industry wouldn't like it, but that was his solution. I'm just quoting.
A radical
Don't shoot the
solution.
Messenger.
And things got worse in a way, because the defending Tour de France champion Geraint Thomas then had a crash at the Tour of Switzerland yesterday and has pulled out of the race, but we understand he has the all clear for the Tour de France, still got 2 weeks to recover. We gather suffering the effects of concussion today. They'll obviously monitor him, but we don't think that his position in the Tour de France is in any doubt. But really difficult week or so for Team Ineos, and we'll talk all about that in the first part of the podcast and recap what actually happened at the Dauphiné as well, which was won by the Danish rider Jakob Fuglsang, who also won the race 2 years ago. Another big stage race win for Astana. They really are having a fantastic season. And an interesting race. We'll talk to Daniel about that, because it didn't start in traditional Dauphiné territory. It started.
Didn't end in traditional Dauphiné territory.
It just skirted with traditional Dauphiné territory. Daniel can fill us in on that when we talk about the Dauphiné in part one. But the highlights of the week really were, other than Fuglsang's win ahead of Van Garderen and Emmanuel Buchmann overall, were the two stage victories for Wout van Aert. In the time trial, perhaps not so surprisingly.
The margin was surprising.
The margin was
astonishing. Yeah.
Beat Van Garderen and Tom Dumoulin Van Garderen, I think, by 31 seconds and Dumoulin by 47 seconds. He then followed that up, Van Aert, with a road stage victory in a sprint finish the following day. There were also stage wins for Julian Alaphilippe, Sam Bennett, the Irish sprinter who keeps delivering victories for Bora Hansgrohe but won't be going to the Tour de France, Edvald Boasenhagen, Dylan Teuns, Wout Poels and Dylan Van Baarle were the other stage winners. Adam Yates led the race but then fell ill over the final weekend and pulled out on the final day, so no overall result for him. An eventful Dauphiné this year. The Tour de Suisse is underway as well. That's still got a few days to run, but so far Rowan Dennis has won the opening time trial, and there have been stage wins for Luis Leon Sanchez and Elia Viviani and Peter Sagan. Only his third victory of the season. Quite surprising, really, when you consider how prolific he is normally, but perhaps signs of some form as he bids to go for yet another green jersey at the Tour.
He had an absolutely brilliant lead out from Jasper Stuyven for that. Of Trek Segafredo.
Did you see Trek Segafredo's social media post afterwards talking about the conversation, suggesting it was a friendly conversation between John Degenkolb and Jasper Stuyven, just comparing notes about how the lead out had gone? I would suggest that it wasn't too cordial.
It was genuinely one of the best lead outs I've ever seen.
unfortunately not teammates, of course, though. The Belgium Tour was also on, and that was won by teenager Remco Evenepoel. He also won a stage, and there were victories for Tim Wellens in the time trial and Victor Campenaerts as well, but a real breakthrough victory for Evenepoel, who has had a lot of hype in his first year as a professional for De Koninck Quickstep, and winning the Belgium Tour, the Tour of Belgium, that is a significant victory for him. Chris Nylands of Israel Cycling Academy won the Tour of Hungary, and then there was also the Mont Ventoux Denivelle Challenge race, which you're holding your nose. You think this is a stinker of a race?
No, right? we were chatting about this beforehand. Maybe we'll return to it.
Over a glass of vermouth, we're discussing this. I think it's a very flawed concept.
Well, I thought it was a dreadful race.
I thought it looked great. I love Mont Ventoux, and the surprise opportunity to see a race on Mont Ventoux, a one-day race on Mont Ventoux, that it was interesting. The field wasn't great, but the duel between Romain Bardet and Jesus Herrada was interesting, no? And Bardet was coming out of the Dauphiné, where he'd finished 10th overall, not a brilliant week for him. And Herrada, who's won two stages in the overall at the Tour of Luxembourg and had a bit of a few days off, really did a number on him. I thought it was interesting.
Should finish at the bottom. The computer is my opinion.
Says no.
They should
what before they climb it?
Yeah.
Just a crit round Carpentras. Is that your idea for a one day race? Is it?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. No. It would be. It could be good, but yeah, I would. Would should they should include the descent down to where would they finish? Vaison-la-Romaine.
So go over the top and, yeah, and round into the...
Yeah, and there have been good stages of Tour de France stages that have finished where they've gone over the Ventoux. Eros Poli is probably the most famous Tour de France stage ever featuring the Ventoux in 1994. Finished in Carpentras, didn't it? Mm. Won by Eros Poli after an epic breakaway. Something like that would make more sense. I just didn't... you know, I don't know how many teams were in the field, but I could identify about five climbers in the whole field of over 150 riders, which, you know, is a reflection on how stretched the rosters are. And I just thought that that was a bit of a shame.
But this is a different issue. It's saying it was not a great field and saying it's not a great race are two issues. I'd agree with you on the field, but I think...
Well, it wasn't a great race this year. It wasn't a great race.
No, but it was.
It's a one-day race that finishes.
Nice for a snooze.
Yeah, it's a one-day race that finishes on top of a mountain. Ever going to be a tactically interesting race? I would suggest not.
Well, it's like a time trial.
You were saying, Daniel, the old Classic des Alpes one-day race, which was not as hard as riding Mont Ventoux. It was kind of medium, almost like a medium mountain stage of the Tour de France back in the day, wasn't it? And perhaps also coming a day after the Dauphiné, not the ideal slot. Maybe as a warm-up for the Dauphiné, it would be better. But maybe I'm biased because, you know, I went and rode Mont Ventoux 3 years ago, made a friend of the podcast special, which is on the free podcast feed for a limited time only. If you want to hear that, be quick, because I think it'll be taken back down again.
You want to hear some heavy breathing.
Heavy breathing. There's swear words in it as well. I forgot about that. I had to put the language advisory notice on the old podcast for that one. But that's available for people to listen to if they want. One other small bit of news from the other week was that there was the Hammer Series, the latest of the Hammer Series races in Limburg in the Netherlands. That was won by De Koning Quickstep. And next year, in February, there will be a Hammer Series event for men and the first women's event held in Colombia. So that's something to look forward to. Maybe that would be my debut at a Hammer Series race. I quite fancy a trip to Colombia in February.
London to Brighton semi-classic. Does that not feature New Year's Roundup?
We all rode, Daniel didn't ride the London to Brighton, but Richard, you and I rode with Simon, the photographer, and...
Jonathan Rowe, Adam Bowie, Paul Scoynes, David Luxton, various members of the cycling podcast team, Rose Manley as well.
Tom Carey as well, our colleague from the Telegraph, and it was a great day despite terrible weather, wasn't it? Terrible weather, but it was nice to arrive in Brighton on the beach. And so far we've raised £1,400 for the British Heart Foundation, which is the charity that runs the London to Brighton ride. And if you would like to top that up, well, why not? It's a great charity, and we are grateful to their support in terms of sponsoring the podcast for a few episodes in the last few weeks. You can go to justgiving.com/the-cycling-podcast and you can donate as little as £2, and if everyone who had a heart donated £2, then we'd have quite a lot of money, wouldn't we? Just very lastly, another thing I need to tell the listeners about: if you're going to be in Brussels for the Grand Depart of the Tour de France, we'll be there too, and we are hosting a little event at the Brussels Beer Project on Friday, July the 5th from 7:30 till 9 p.m. And if you would like to come along to that, tickets are available on a first come first serve basis. Go to beercity.brussels/events and you can find out how to get a ticket.
The fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
I like the bib shirt of Rafa because they're really comfortable. My name is Alberto Bettiol and I race for Team EF Education First. Yesterday I also tested him in the cobbles and they are pretty good. No, I have any issue about it. So I'm looking forward to keep on riding with the chemise of Rafa, and I recommend you, all of you guys, all this bib shirt.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for being our headline sponsor at the Cycling Podcast. We are very appreciative of their support. And Lionel and I were very honoured last night to host an event organised by Simon Mottram of RAFA, raising money for Ambitious About Autism. That was good fun. I must also mention the latest EF Gone Racing film made by RAFA. You'll find it on their YouTube channel. And it covers Lachlan Morton, Alex Howes and Taylor Finney's efforts at Dirty Kanza recently. This is the first of their kind of alternative calendar outings, and I have
to
say
it's like Pyro Bay for millennials, isn't it?
26 minutes long, I think it is, the film, so it's the longest one, and it's really good. I recommend it. I watched it this morning, and I didn't know much about Dirty Kanza. It looked fantastic. It looked great fun, actually. And so, yeah, have a look at that. It's really worth watching. Well, Daniel, you're just back from the Dauphiné, and it was a dramatic race. Not a great race.
No, it was a poor race. It was a poor race.
A poor race, from a spectacle
point of view.
But lots of drama, not least Chris Froome.
Yeah, the route wasn't particularly set up for a dramatic finale. We didn't get a dramatic finale. The final stage was, it was a mountain stage, but more of a medium mountain stage. The climbs were not particularly steep. There was a tailwind on the final part of the stage. So, yeah, we expected a big grand finale, something similar to the Dauphiné 2 years ago that Jakob Fuglsang won, sort of snatched from Richie Port, where Port was put under pressure almost from kilometre zero on the final day. We've seen that a few times in the Dauphiné the last few years. There have been some absolute humdingers of final stages, but this one, alas, was a bit of a damp squib.
The weather was pretty terrible for a good half of the race, wasn't it? Cold and wet. And riders, were they suffering from the effects? I mean, Adam Yates kind of fell ill. Was that weather related, do we know?
I think so, Napalm. I think probably. The weather conditions were pretty biblically bad on the Saturday. Hailstorms, and we thought one stage that the stage wasn't going to finish. It did. But yeah, a few guys suffered. Stephen Kreiswijk suffered as well on the last day, fell ill. Yates as well. The kind of illnesses we think they'll probably be able to get over in the space of 2 or 3 days shouldn't, at this stage, 3 weeks out from Tour de France, affect their preparations too much, I wouldn't have thought.
Froome. I mean, you messaged us, Daniel, that was where I heard about his crash. Can you just tell us why? Because they're obviously warming up for the time trial, doing their reconnaissance when the accident happened. I mean, where were you? How did you hear about it? How did word filter back?
Well, I was moonlighting in my other role. So I was working for ITV and the Dauphiné. And what usually happens on a time trial day is, we have a highlights program from the Dauphiné. So in the morning, we'll typically go out onto the course to film some of the recce, which the footage will then be used for some voiceover. Gary Imlach back in the studio in London will then say, you know, Chris Froome, here's Chris Froome this morning going out on his recce. And so that's what we did. We had word from Ineos the previous day that they were going to go out about 12 o'clock. We positioned ourselves from 3 or 4, so the cameraman and I, we positioned ourselves 3 or 4 kilometres down the route before Ineos were due to get there. So we saw pretty much the whole field come through on their recces. Then we saw Wout Poels and Chris Froome. The footage has kind of gone viral because there are not many journalists at the Dauphiné. There are not many TV crews. We were, I think, the only people who filmed the recce. And there was a kind of a curious and, as it turned out, sort of serendipitous or ominous conversation between Wout Poels and Chris Froome that we overheard and was caught on the camera. And Wout Poels telling Chris Froome not to take any risks, but he was sort of joking as Froome was putting on a long sleeve jersey. And so then they disappeared, and there was a climb on the route, so they were going to do this climb and then descend back into Roanne. In the meantime, we'd gone back to Roanne. The teams were all set up outside the press room pretty much. We have to send our footage then, which we did. Takes a while, probably took us half an hour or so. We went back out to the bus expecting Chris Froome to be back and to be finishing his recce. And we've been told that he would speak to us afterwards. Anyway, we waited longer than we expected to wait. And a certain point, the Ineos press officer, George, came over and said, Chris won't be speaking when he comes back. And we sort of laughed and said, well, what have we done? You know, surely we kind of upset him in the time between us filming him on the recce and, you know, now. And George didn't really know what to respond to that, I don't think. Anyway, he then went off. We saw with hindsight what was, you know, scenes of consternation around the bus. We didn't know what was going on. But then Dave Brailsford came over and said, look, Froome has crashed. It's bad. He's going to be out of the Tour de France. And that was the bombshell dropping. At that point, when you know you're working for television, you've got a lot of sort of decisions to make. Do you go to the hospital? Was Froome at the hospital? It turned out he wasn't at the hospital. We didn't know that at that stage. And we were also told that there'd be more comment from Ineos in due course. So we decided, having spoken to our director, that the best thing to do would be to stay at the team bus and not to go off to the hospital in Roanne. We thought actually he might be airlifted to Saint-Etienne. We thought he might go to Lyon. So that was also difficult. It's also difficult to get back out onto the course. The course was a kind of loop, and it would have meant having to cross the course a couple of times. So there are all sorts of things that just made it seem risky to kind of pursue the story in that way. So we stayed at the bus. Dave Brailsford spoke to us at about 3:30, and it was only after that that we found out that Froome was still at the spot where he'd crashed. And then we started hearing from a few people who had seen it. Dan Martin had seen it. Seb Piquet, our friend, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, he's also race radio at the Dauphiné. He had seen Froome shortly after he'd crashed, or he'd seen the scene developing with ambulances and so forth.
Daniel, he was at the scene for a couple of hours.
Yes.
With medics who...
Yes. As far as, I think 2 hours was what was mentioned afterwards by most people. I think L'Equipe reported about 2 hours. Certainly a substantial amount of time. And as I say, that came as a surprise to pretty much everyone. Everyone who was back in Roanne reporting the story had assumed or was under the impression that by that time he was long gone. The TV crew from Danish television TV2 had gone to Roanne to the hospital. They got pretty much nothing. I think finally they did see an Ineos team car because Froome was there for a short time in Roanne. But yeah, it's, you know, I mean, when
at the hospital, you mean?
At the hospital. And then I'm not sure exactly at what time he was airlifted away. But we had sort of covered the story to a large extent by that point, and the order that we got was to then refocus on the time trial itself, because by this point it was sort of 3:30, 4:00 in the afternoon, and the leaders were going out, coming back in. And, you know, it was also very clear from what we're hearing about the crash that it wasn't a routine collarbone break whereby Froome might have been in a position to give us an interview later that day from his hospital bed. It was much more serious than that. So we had to kind of leave the story alone. There's also part of you that doesn't want to be, I mean, obviously you defer to your director, but you don't want to be sort of voyeuristic and kind of mawkish about the thing, going to the hospital and sort of, you know, wandering into hospital wards uninvited. Although sometimes, you know, certain directors I think will probably ask that of you.
I mean, it is a freakish accident in lots of respects. The fact that it happened on the recce, and that it was, you know, taking his hands off the bars and being blown into this wall. Was it a very blustery day? Was it a windy day?
It was quite windy. I mean, we definitely remarked on it. My cameraman and I, in the morning when we were out on the course watching the guys go past on recces. Difficult to know when you're not on a bike and you're not on a time trial bike with a disc wheel, but yeah, it was pretty blustery. It wasn't fine weather. I mean, I think if you watch the time trial later that day, it looked as though the weather was set fairly fair. That hadn't been the case in the morning, and as I understand it, certainly where the crash happened, it was, I wouldn't say it was a built-up area, but there were, you know, houses either side of the road, detached houses with sort of, you know, gardens in between them. So I think there were kind of wind tunnels. And as I understand it, it was at a point like that where he did feel, well, he was kind of buffeted by the wind. But the, you know, the other thing is people wondered why it hadn't been filmed, it hadn't been seen by members of the public. The Dauphiné, if you go back and watch footage of any stage of the Dauphiné last week, you realise how few people actually attend the Dauphiné. I mean, it's most days it starts and finishes in tiny villages. Rouen's a reasonable sized town, but this was a village 5 or 6 kilometres outside Rouen. I don't know if there was anyone at the roadside at the point where he did crash, but it's quite conceivable that it was only a small handful of people who could even conceivably have witnessed it.
Dan Martin obviously was following, wasn't he? And he gave, he spoke about it a day or so later. He'd obviously been quite shaken up by it because it looked shocking to him. But the severity of the injuries, I think, took everybody by surprise. You know, I mean,
hours in surgery to stabilise those brakes as well.
Yeah. So a long road back for a rider who's just turned 34.
Yeah, and well, I mean, we'd be speculating about, you know, how that recovery will go, but you're right, it is a long road back, and it completely changes Team Ineos's plans for the Tour de France at fairly short notice. I mean, Richard, they've already had the situation earlier in the season with Egan Bernal, who was supposed to go to the Giro as Ineos's team leader, and then he had a crash.
Allegedly, according to Richard.
Well, yeah.
I'd like to put on the record that any speculation on my part in an earlier podcast was uninformed and incorrect speculation. I'd just like to put that on the record.
So Bernal will now be in the team.
Well, Daniel's presented me with photographic evidence of Bernal's scar following his surgery on his collarbone, so I'm happy to accept that.
Well, Bernal will be at the Tour de France, of course, and
the reason why I suggested that Bernal's crash might not have happened was because back in March I spoke to somebody at Team Sky, as it was then, and they spoke about really quite advanced plans to remove Bernal from the Giro and put him in the Tour team. And
was the person you spoke to Egan Bernal?
No. And the reason for that, and the reason why, you know, I thought that there might have been some effort to not appear to take Bernal out of the Giro team by choice, is because there was quite a lot of pressure on Team Sky to put having won the Giro the previous year, to put up a good defence of it this year. So to have either Geraint Thomas or Bernal in the race. Thomas didn't want to go. Pinarello as well, their bike sponsor, maybe influential in this. They're a sponsor of the Giro and their Italian company. But Thomas obviously wanted to go back to the Tour Defence title. And Bernal was, you know, leading the team at the Giro. And it all seemed quite convenient. But I'm sure that he did crash and break his collarbone. I have no reason to doubt that at all.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, Race Radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Harry's Razors. The Tour de France is looming, Richard. 3 weeks on the road. Have you got enough stocks of Harry's Razors to take with you?
Well, as you know, Lionel, I subscribe now to Harry's Razors. I get a fresh razor blades every couple of months. They know exactly how many I need. They know how often I shave because I told them. And they arrive in the post. Very handy, that is, too. One of the things that you often forget when you're in the supermarket. So that's handy. But Harry's are offering a special trial set to listeners of the Cycling Podcast for £3.95. All you have to do is go to harrys.com/cycling. And in that trial set, you will get everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel and travel blade cover. And I can heartily endorse the Harry's razor, which I've been using now for about 2 years, and looking good, haven't I, Lionel?
Absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely.
Okay. No. Get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support the Cycling Podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel and the travel blade cover. For £3.95, go to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling.
So what do we know now? We know that Bernal will be at the Tour. We know that Chris Froome won't. We think that Geraint Thomas will recover. We don't know what kind of impact this will have on his preparations now. I mean,
and he's so by a series of total coincidences, it may well transpire that what happens is that Bernal does lead Team Ineos into the Tour de France.
Well, what about Wout Poels, who won the most difficult stage of the Dauphiné in pretty impressive circumstances? I mean, he sprung a late move that left everyone standing, really, and that looked like a statement of intent almost.
Would you put your money on Bernal or Poels?
I don't know. I mean, Bernal clearly has has a kind of the pedigree in the sense of, you know, just a kind of a real talent. Poels, we kind of know a bit more about, a bit more of a known quantity, whereas Bernal, we don't really know yet how he will hold up under the pressure of leading a team and trying to actually win the Tour de France. I mean, the big difference between, you know, finishing in, you know, the sort of, you know, top 20, top 10, top 5, top 3, and actually winning the race, I mean, they are big, big jumps, aren't they? And as talented as Bernal obviously is, you know, can he do it? We just don't know yet. We don't really have enough evidence to go on. Whereas Poel, and that's what's quite exciting about the prospect of Bernal. Thomas, we know we can use last year's race as a kind of benchmark, assuming that he's fit and healthy when the race starts. Poels, we kind of know that, you know, he blows a bit hot and cold over 3 weeks, but that's because he's been in a team role, I guess. We've not really seen him as a leader.
Beyond that team, though, what did we learn from the Dauphiné about other contenders, not least Fuglsang, the revelation of the season?
Well, Fuglsang was imperious, really, from start to finish. Was it the second day when there was a bit of sort of unexpected general classification action in the Comtal region, and Fuglsang took a time bonus. He was the best of the general classification riders. He was never really in trouble, and in fact looked the strongest of the general classification riders, looked the strongest of in a field that had some pretty stellar climbing talent in it, for the best climbers really we've seen this year, Thibaut Pinot, Adam Yates. He looked the strongest of all of them, and really looked like a different rider, different animal from the Fuglsang we've known over the past few years, who's been a good rider, a solid rider. But, you know, he's a guy who's done 12 Grand Tours in his career, has finished in the top 10 twice, won 7th place, won 10th place. A lot of those Grand Tours have been in support of other riders, but he's someone who's struggled in Grand Tours. And prior to this year, he's also a rider that no one really would have picked out as a threat to win the Tour de France. I now think he's in the top three or four riders most likely to win it.
Very different win at the Dauphiné this year. I mean, his win a couple of years ago was a real smash and grab affair, and he benefited from the others ganging up on Richie Porte. This was a very different type of win, and, you know, he was, as you say, the strongest in the race and supported by a really, really strong team who were watching them, you know, dominate the Dauphiné and then go, you know, have a different team at Tour of Switzerland and ride very strongly there as well.
Yeah, and I just sense with him that, I mean, he's talked an awful lot about confidence, and there's no doubt that, you know, Astana are having this stellar season, whatever the reasons are. They're having an incredible season, particularly in stage races. The number of stage races they've won this year is quite staggering. But Fuglsang seems like a rider who's suddenly become very comfortable in his own skin. He's already achieved more this season, well, enough to make this season an unqualified success. And even at the Dauphiné, you know, I asked him on the last morning, if he wasn't to win it, would it be a big drama? And he said, well, not really, because, you know, my season, in a certain sense, you could consider it complete already. He'd already won the Dauphiné, so he was very cool and phlegmatic about that. But I kind of feel he's getting to that point about even the Tour and possibly everything else left in his career. He's 34 years old, and he just seems to me to be sort of very serene, and that kind of serenity is obviously enabling to get the best out of himself. And he's also, you know, backed up by this incredibly strong team of very aggressive riders, climbers. You know, they're not a team that's going to ride the Tour in the same way that an Ineos would ride the Tour, a sort of Catenaccio style with, you know, six riders on the front setting a fast tempo, although that's what Astana did on the last stage. Astana's style tends to be more aggressive. They send guys down the road. They like to counterattack. So it'll be a very different kind of race if Fuglsang is to win it. But I think he's got a good chance.
I think there is a sense that it's sort of now or never for somebody like Fuglsang this season. I mean, you mentioned his results. Just to run through the stage race and one-day results he's had so far this season. Second at Strade Bianche, third at the Amstel Gold Race, second at Flèche Wallonne, won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, of course, and then in the stage race, he's third at Tirreno-Adriatico, fourth at Tour of the Basque Country, and now winning the Dauphiné. That is a real collection of sort of results that kind of put you in mind a little bit of the sort of the Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome, Geraint Thomas.
Exactly,
sort
the,
of
the momentum that's carried through
blocks,
from the spring
into the Tour. And so you're right, and the Tour is all about confidence and momentum, isn't it? And it's a lot more perhaps defensive in a way than the Giro.
The other guy, though, I think who falls into that category, who we'd probably be talking about had he finished the race, is Adam Yates. You know, he was on the brink of a second overall in the Dauphiné. He's had a similar, maybe not quite as spectacular, but a strong, series of results all year. And he's carrying that into the Tour as well.
Yeah, and probably banished most doubts about his time trialing with a very strong ride in the time trial. You know, there's only one individual time trial in the Tour de France this year. It's not that long. It's 27 kilometres. There's a climb in it, as there was in the time trial at the Dauphiné. So I don't think it's going to have that much impact. You're talking 1 minute, a minute and a half from the best GC rider for Adam Yates in that time trial. That's all he has to make up. And you know, I think people have not really realised or acknowledged enough just how hard this year's Tour de France route is. I think it's one of the sort of gnarliest, most challenging for years. I mean, I was looking earlier today, and I think there are 10 definite GC days where there's no doubt there'll be movement on general classification, and there are probably four maybes on top of that. You've got the Courmayeur de Rosellon, the Iseron, Val Thorens, Galibier and Tourmalet, which are all climbs where it's over an hour of climbing, seven times to 2,000 meters in 3 days in the Alps. So you know, all that, you add all that up, and I think you know, it's one for the climbers. It is, you know, those difficulties do give me some reservations about Fuglsang and some of the other guys you might think are sort of borderline. They've not really done it in the past, because to me, the winner of this Tour de France is someone who is a bit of an expert at negotiating not just a few pitfalls, negotiating not just a few GC days, but they're going to have to negotiate a lot of them. And I think that is going to be a huge test of a rider's ability to sort of construct that 3 weeks, which, you know, we've talked about before with Geraint Thomas and Richie Port, guys like this who, you know, they've had a tendency to crash or they've had a tendency to have a bad day. And, you know, Fuglsang, to be honest, falls into that category, whereas you've got the real experts like the Froomes, who've really created a dynasty out of just bouncing off those, you know, those issues and those problems.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products. You're going to chant the code, the discount code, Lionel, like Orla and Rose did last week?
No, I'm not. But I did have a bar and a gel during the London to Brighton on.
Thought you were going
Sunday.
Well.
Yeah.
Thought you were going
yeah,
well.
I suddenly had a. Suddenly
a
had a
spurt.
Real spurt. Yeah, just on the approach to Ditchling Beacon.
I noticed that.
But then Simon the photographer just pedalled away. I mean,
he was good, wasn't he?
He
looked like
good.
Mikel Landa up there. Anyway,
didn't look back, did he?
No. So Science and Sport, 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. When I say it, I hear the chant in my head, SISCP25, scienceandsport.com. Daniel, you didn't catch any of the women's tour coverage, did you? There was a very spectacular effort by Orla one day in her story of the stage to She included everyday local literary or song references in her story of the stage. One day, the day that we went all the way around Coventry, she managed to combine the two sort of local literary heavyweights, Philip Larkin and Daniel Freeb.
Oh, really?
Don't know if you caught that.
Did you go around Coventry?
It went all the way around Coventry, yeah. And it was really
I got a tweet about that.
It was ingenious.
Yeah.
Have a listen. It's really good. Quotes from your wonderful biography of Eddie Merckx, and they were segued into a bit of Larkin. I mean, difficult to tell them apart, to be honest.
Very difficult. I mean, two literary giants, obviously.
Well, literary giants and a certain sensibility.
Larkin's book on Eddie Merckx is excellent.
the third Merckx biography. Anyway, we'll be returning to the Eddie Merckx biography, I think, before the tour, but we'll do that at some point. Picking up some loose threads from the Dauphiné, Tom Dumoulin went there having crashed out the Giro, and you mentioned he didn't perform perhaps as he would have wished in the time trial that Wout van Aert won, and the signs from Dumoulin aren't that encouraging, are they?
No, I didn't think so. I thought he was a bit out of sorts. Spoke to him a few times, and he seemed a bit sheepish about the knee. The fact that he's still talking about it, the fact that he was still talking about it already was a little bit alarming. Then he pulled out and went back to Holland for supposedly more checks, more scans. And already, the Dutch journalists at the Dauphiné sensed that something fairly major was up, that things had not gone according to plan. And because he was due back in the Alps a couple of days later for a training camp. And then, we've subsequently found out that he had another minor operation on the knee. And I think, was it yesterday or the day before, he was on his way back to the Alps and they turned round, I think when he was 2 hours down the road, turned back having decided that no, he wasn't quite ready for this yet. Which is a bit worrying, because the way it was put to us at the Dauphiné on Sunday was that at least at the training camp in the Alps, he'd be able to do exactly the exercises that his knee could definitely cope with at the moment, rather than in a race basically being having to respond to race circumstances and almost being kind of bent out of shape.
On the other hand, this operation to remove some shrapnel, something from his knee, which he obviously picked up at the Giro, if that resolves the problem that he's had, because he's been getting pain in his knee, and that's clearly why. It sounds like a pretty minor procedure. If that resolves the problem, then, he's still got a couple of weeks to get over that and be fit for the tour. The question may be the lack of racing and the lack of preparation, and this might apply to Geraint Thomas as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I looked at that earlier, Rich, just days of racing this year, because it struck me, I mean, I feel as though Thomas has not raced very much at all. If he doesn't race again, so he crashed out of the Tour of Switzerland, he will have 24 days of racing by the time he lines up at the Tour de France. I think perhaps even more worrying, he'll only have 36 since last year's Tour de France. 12 of those were at the end of last year, and I think he's only really competed in one race, competed as in sort of race for a result, and that was the Tour de Romandie where he came third. But Fuglsang's 32 days of racing before the Tour will have, or maybe 33 if he does the National Championships. Dumoulin 27, Yates 35. I just looked at some from the last few years. So last year, Thomas was 29. Going back from there, Froome 26, Froome 26, Froome 27. Nibali in 2014, 42 races, 42 days before the Tour de France. So Froome 30, Wiggins 30, Evans 28, Andy Schleck 37. So the sort of ballpark figure has been around 30. 24 is not very many.
But Geraint Thomas, also, he crashed out Tirreno Adriatico. He had an altitude camp in Tenerife cut short because of snow. And these are the building blocks that you need. And you sensed, that last year when Geraint Thomas won the Tour, he did so because everything had gone right and nothing had gone wrong. And somebody like Froome, who, seemed apparently to have really turned himself around, he seems to be able to do that where other guys can't do it quite so easily. And by all accounts, we heard that Thomas and Froome were knocking lumps out of each other in Tenerife, both going very well recently. So,
and you wonder, you know, what I said about the Tour de France route, and it's also a fast start to this year's Tour de France. You know, mountain stage, medium mountain stages in the Vosges very early, like before the end of the first week. Does that help or hinder someone who comes in without, who's maybe a little bit rusty, not? Well, they'll be fresh, but maybe not quite race ready. I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, obviously, it doesn't help them. But then, if the race sort of decants quickly, and you know, the general classification starts to take shape quite quickly, that could make it a bit less stressful. You know, someone who's worried about crashing or who is vulnerable to crashes, someone Thomas has been in the past. Let's face it, you'd be worried about. Maybe 8 days of flat stages, which end in bunch sprints with Geraint Thomas, just based on his past record. So it might help him that that the GC battle kicks off very quickly. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be hard though, couldn't it? The first stage going over the Mur and the Bosberg. Mm. I mean, that even if they don't race it like the Tour of Flanders, it's still all about punch and positioning and a bit of luck and avoiding any. Crashes and then a team time trial, which is it's not long or you know, particularly daunting, but that's a really intense effort where you know, somebody will get caught out and lose more than you'd expect, and the momentum will be set very early on. And like you say, Daniel, you know, the Wednesday and Thursday, I think the La Planche des Belles Filles stage is on the Thursday, so there's no gentle introduction to the Tour at all this year. And as you've already said, really from the midway point in the race, it is on every day. There's something significant every single day, all the way up to Paris. So no easing in, I don't think, and no kind of no downtime, not significant downtime. So it's looking incredibly open.
Are we going to preview the Tour de France in the next two podcasts?
We probably are. That's how
it works, isn't it?
That is how it works. Everything leads to the Tour now. And I mean, well, you look at the Dauphiné and
it offers clues, doesn't it?
It does offer clues, and sometimes those clues are a real kind of misdirection. I mean, Fuglsang is kind of the topic du jour now, isn't he? TJ Van Garderen, probably the worst possible result for him, finishing second, because that ramps up expectations on him. Being fifth in the Tour twice before, kind of the big American hope, there'll be a lot of expectation now on him. And, well, we've seen in the past, you know, one of the things he doesn't particularly seem to like is a lot of expectation on his shoulders.
And maybe he was already deflecting that when, well, he said to me on Sunday that Rigoberto Urán is there. Leader, their
strong,
captain.
Strong team, because Mike Woods was riding very well. He had to pull out with illness as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
He was riding very well at the Dauphiné, so they've got a very good, sort of well-balanced team of Bettiol as well going there.
And just on the first week, I always find it fascinating, and this was also the case at the Giro, just to see how different teams approach this question of the first week. And you know, we talked to the Giro a lot about how Mitchelton tend to surround their leader with rulers in a similar way to BMC did when Cadel Evans won the Tour de France. And then on the other hand, you have a team like Astana, who, well, that's not their forte and never has been, and they will look to race completely differently. And what, you know, one of those approaches obviously will prove to be the right approach with this year's first week, first 10 days being the way they are.
And what about Wout van Aert then? Won two stages, a time trial and a sprint, and has looked good all season, and is going to the Tour de France for the first time with Jumbo-Visma. And Primoz Roglic is not going to the Tour de France, having initially, we think, been planning to do the Giro and the Tour. Obviously, his Giro unravelled, having looked so good. So good that Richard crowned him the winner after about nine or ten days.
No, it's day one.
Day one.
I
and
said
then,
he'd won
then
it.
Again after 9 or 10 days. You couldn't see him being beaten. But he unravelled pretty spectacularly, didn't he?
He finished third.
Yeah, but it was he was tumbling downhill though, wasn't he? Do you not think?
I think he's being judged by some of the expectations going into the race rather than the actual result.
Well, judged by the first 10 days, surely. I mean, he looked.
Yeah, I mean, Simon Yates tumbled down the classification last year. I think Roglic finishing on the podium was not a bad result, but we could see that his form was dipping. Mm. And so I think we said that we'd be surprised if he rode the tour given that, and given the season he's had.
So Wout van Aert, though, I mean, dream scenario is that he could be a credible challenger to Peter Sagan in the race for the green jersey, no?
Be careful what you say about Wout van Aert, because a couple of the Belgian colleagues, our Belgian colleagues at the Dauphiné, were telling me that he reads absolutely everything that's written about him.
Does he listen to podcasts?
And often, oh, I don't know, often will comment to the journalists, the offending journalists,
really?
The following day. Yeah,
oh, that's fine.
Wow. Keeps you on your toes.
So can he challenge Peter Sagan for the green jersey then, Daniel?
He shouldn't be able to. He really shouldn't be able to, because he will have his hands full. He'll have his hands full trying to complete, well, more than 8 consecutive days of racing for the first time in his life. Yeah. He'll have his hands full in Dylan Groenewegen's lead-out train. And presumably he'll also be expected to, well, on those days that we mentioned in the Vosges, which is already the first week, he'll have to do something there for Stephen Kreiswijk.
So that's a no.
That's a
sorry
no.
Sorry, Wout, if you're listening. Before we wrap things up, can I mention Remco Evenepoel's victory in the Tour of Belgium?
Yeah, I think that would be absolutely spot on.
How long before Remco it becomes Remco,
I think,
in the vein,
right,
of, yeah, Shaq and Michael and
19 years
Pavel.
Old, you know,
Pavel.
19 years old, you know, quite a controversial. I think Jonathan Vaughters said that he had texted Patrick Lefebvre to sort of dress him down for signing an 18-year-old and putting him under that sort of pressure of riding the World Tour already. And he's not at the easiest of years, but he's shown in flashes, you know, the talent that he's clearly got. But I think we all wondered whether that just not winning as frequently as he did before turning professional might just wear him down a bit. And I think at the Tour of Belgium, I think if he goes on to become, you know, a great champion, we'll probably look back on this Tour of Belgium in his first year in the same way that we look back on, you know, Greg LeMond's early results or something, as being a sign of the talent. And the way, well, we saw Adam Blythe last night, who was riding that race, didn't see a lot of Remco Evenepoel, he said, but he was riding that race and his teammate Victor Campenaerts was second. Now Victor Campenaerts, you know, maybe not the best road racing cyclist in the world, but the world record holder, very strong time trialist, and Evenepoel just rode him off his wheel a couple of times. Not just Campenaerts, but Tim Wellens as well, who's a, you know, very, very accomplished rider and a strong rider. And it was a really impressive display at the Tour of Belgium. Stage win was kind of reminiscent of his World Championship win last year. He just seems to be able to ride people off his wheel. Adam Blythe gave us a load of figures about the watts that Campenaerts was putting out just to try and keep up with him. And
they sounded high watts.
They sounded like a lot of watts.
Yeah.
And the guy's clearly got a huge talent, a huge engine. And it is just a case for that team, De Koning Quickstep, of, you know, trying to manage that and trying to release it at certain points while not, you know, just keeping the pressure off him a little bit.
Yeah, I think criticising Lefebvre for signing someone who clearly is a big talent because he's a teenager, I think that's a bit strange. I think the key is how they do manage him.
Well, you can mention that when you have lunch with Jonathan Vaughters quite soon.
Well, maybe I will, yeah. The key is, you know, kind of a quick, slow approach, you know, expose him to something. I mean, let's not forget the Belgium Tour, it's not a World Tour race. I mean, it's a big deal in Belgium, and that will certainly have caught the eye of the media there, Evenepoel winning, but
it wasn't a super field.
Overexposing him to racing. And let's not overlook the fact that if De Koning Quickstep hadn't signed him, somebody else would have done, and that's how sport works. And there's no benefit in the even the short term to flogging him while he's still a teenager. They've got to be gentle with him. I think where Lefebvre deserves some criticism is the comments in the press about Evenepoel's weight and you know the fact that he was it's too heavy for the sort of super skinny world of the World Tour. Perhaps be a little bit more gentle on that sense. No, I mean, yeah, give him some time. Daniel,
yeah, but I think, as I say,
I don't know. I think
part of the job. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, it is. It's not. Yeah, it is. But yeah, I guess
it's part of it's just part. It's in a way. It's the same as, you know, expecting results from him, isn't it? It's pressure, and maybe that at that age and stage in his development, he shouldn't be put under the pressure to perform and win races or to be as skinny as he'll probably need to be when he's a bit later on. Maybe it's, but what do we know? We're not managing anybody. We can barely manage ourselves. I was going to mention something else there. Just quickly on that Team De Kooning Quickstep, we're speaking a day after Elia Viviani won, having obviously been very disappointed at the Giro not to win. And it was really noticeable how effective Yves Lampaert and Michael Morkov in particular were for Viviani. And you look at, I mean, obviously Viviani will go to the Tour de France with those two guys to help him there. You wonder if Morkov in particular had been at the Giro as he was last year, maybe Viviani would have won a couple of stages there, because he's such a good lead out man. Not only did he lead him out perfectly, he then just drifted ever so slightly to the right to impede Peter Sagan a little bit without breaking any rules, or, you know, he just created a little bit more space for Sagan to come around and help Viviani.
Are you going to be the best sprinter at the Tour?
Well, that's what I wondered,
Or the Atomic Tadpole.
Well, the Atomic Tadpole.
Groenewegen. Did you, this completely passed me by, I don't know how, but are you familiar with these rumours that Marcel Kittel is going to sign for Jumbo Visma?
Oh yeah, heard that. When I thought about it, I thought, there is a team out there who really do need a fast sprinter, and maybe you should go there. But then I remember the team was Katusha.
Yeah,
Alpecin.
I was about to say, yeah, yeah.
That wouldn't really probably work. But yeah, that was a rumour, wasn't it? What would that be for?
To ride something resembling a B program.
Interesting, yeah.
That was what I heard at the Dauphiné, but it's a rumour at this stage.
Well, should we, before we go actually, I should mention that we, having sold out of limited edition mugs made by Stacey Snyder at the Giro, she's producing more mugs for the Tour de France, and all money raised from sales of the mugs will go to a good cause or good causes. Please send a nomination. And if you nominate a good cause for the Giro and we didn't pick you, apologies, because we've got some great nominations. Just nominate again. Don't be put off. Don't think that because your nomination wasn't accepted first time around, it won't be this time around. There were a couple that we were really, you know, close to picking last time around. So please do send again. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. And raised over $2,000 for good causes. It was the Kelly Catlin Fund and Ride for Charlie, and that money has been paid to those respective good causes now. So please do nominate a good cause before the Tour de France comes out. I think we've got a very special coming, subject to it happening next week. Lionel, don't want to give anything away here, but
on. I mean, I mean, just don't start having a go at me about my weight. That would be just too much pressure for me as a young rider.
Never. But yeah, we're hoping that we're going to be able to release a special that'll be hopefully quite good before the Tour de France, and you can get that if you sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Have we any other business, chaps, this week?
I think so.
Part two of the Tour de France preview next week,
and then part three the following week. I think that's a press conference, isn't it? Are we doing before the
Tour? Press conference. Get your questions in for the Tour de France pre-race press conference. We'll answer as many of them as we possibly can. The number
is +44 7971 338 205. That's +44 7971 338 205. Leave a voice memo on WhatsApp, and we'll answer as many questions as we can in a couple of weeks. But until next week, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps. You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.